Okay, I would like to thank the organizers for the invitation and for giving me the opportunity to present our result at this meeting. As several people has mentioned during this meeting, the phase diagram of the cuprates and the bniptides are very rich and have multiple autoparameters that often are competing. And as Berdinov mentioned in the Monday session, this is a dream for experimentalists. It also means that if you have 30 minutes presentation, you would have to focus your talk on one particular aspect or a few particular aspects of the problem. So in this talk, I would speak about charge density wave order in the cuprates that is typically found inside the pseudogap phase and typically around a particular 1,8 doping. I should mention that this topic was pioneered by our chairman, John Troncoda, who more than two decades ago found charge drive order in lanthanum-based cuprates. In this talk, I would speak in terms of charge order. I would speak about charge order, field-induced charge order in YBCO, and I would discuss these recent contributions to the field. And I will try to add a little bit more data, new data. And then in the second half of my talk, I will come back to the lanthanum-based cuprates and show you some new results we have that gives information about the electronic structure of these compounds. Let me start by thanking my collaborators for the YBCO project. We got YBCO samples, single crystal samples from the UBC group in Vancouver. We used the 17 Tesla magnet designed by Ted Forkan and Elizabeth Blackburn at the University of Birmingham, and the experiment was carried out at the Petra Synchrotron in Hamburg. The topic of charge order in YBCO in some sense started 10 years ago with the discovery of quantum oscillations that suggested a reconstruction of electronic reconstruction, and that led people to look for field-induced density wave orders. And that it took some years, and in 2011 and in the years that followed that, several techniques reported charge order in YBCO. And so the problem translated into absence of field-induced density wave order to a problem of understanding why the different techniques had a different magnetic field onsets. So if we took the same sample, for example, the ultrasound experiment would have an onset of 17 Tesla, NMR experiments would report an onset at 10 Tesla, and the X-ray diffraction experiments, either resonant or hard X-ray diffraction experiments, would report charge order even in zero magnetic field. So this was puzzling. For the coming slides, it's important that, or it's interesting to notice that the X-ray experiments reported a charge density wave order at half integer in the outer plane direction and incommensurate in plane along both A and B axis direction with an incommensurability close to 1 over 3. Now, so I would show you some experiments that I think resolved most of these questions surrounding these experiments. And the first one is, that's a really fascinating one. It's often referred to as the Stanford collaboration. What they did was really very creative. They took and synchronized free electron laser X-ray pulses with a pulse of a magnetic field, and in this way they could do X-ray diffraction experiments in magnetic fields up to 30 or 35 Tesla. You can see here that's their, I think this is their zero field experiment, and they reproduced by these peaks here, they reproduced the low field X-ray data with L equal a half modulation. Now I show you the results here. So what is plotted is so if you look at the color maps up here, so you have the outer plane reciprocal axis on the vertical direction, and on the horizontal you have the reciprocal B axis direction. And the finding is that in high magnetic fields, so this is 25 Tesla, you have a new modulation at L equal to 1. So basically, there is a difference in stacking as you go from low fields to high magnetic fields. Now, let me show you, basically this experiment inspired us to go back and do the, so basically that was the cue, the new modulation they found. This inspired us to go back and do our static field synchrotron experiments a bit more careful. And this is our result. Here is L equal one, so this is exactly the modulation that was reported by the Stanford group. What we could show in addition to their experiment was that it happens in a very, suddenly in magnetic field. So at 14 Tesla, there's no sharp peak in at L equal one, and then just increasing the magnetic field by a few Tesla, you have this boom, you have the sharp peak at L equal one. We could also, by looking at the correlation lengths, so we can look at the in-plane correlation length by looking at the width here as function of in-plane reciprocal B-axis momentum, and that's plotted in the top panel here. You can see that it takes off around 10 Tesla. The in-plane correlation length grows dramatically. We can do the same in the outer plane direction, so that's looking at the width in the vertical direction here, and that's what we are plotting in the bottom panel. So this is the C-axis correlation length, and you see that there's a dramatic jump here around 15 Tesla. So basically we could show that the transition happens in two stages. So first the correlation length growth in plane around 10 Tesla, and then at a later field it locks in the outer plane direction. So this could explain why NMR as a local probe would find an onset that is lower than the thermodynamic probes. The other insight that we gained from our experiment was that we repeated the experiment but along the reciprocal B-axis direction. And so this is data shown here. This is the B-axis direction. The difficulty of this experiment is that now you have the chain order that produce a sort of background for you. And so you would need to subtract that. And this is what we have done here. So if you subtract the zero field from the high field, then you remove the chain order signal because that has no magnetic field. And then you get the pure charge density wave intensity. And what you find is that basically the magnetic field, so this is a profile along the reciprocal C-axis direction, you find that the magnetic field enhances the signal around a half integer value, but there's no action going on at L equal 1. So the effect that we are seeing at L equal 1 is highly anisotropic and appears only along the B-axis direction. Now, at the time when we reported this, then of course some people will say, yeah, but I mean, we have a limit of 17 Tesla, and probably this effect here would set in along the A-axis direction just above 17 Tesla. And which was our limit. This is a hardware limit for us. So again, the Stanford collaboration, extended their experiments to the A-axis direction, and indeed they found, so they can show here up to 30 Tesla, they find no evidence of the L equal 1 along the A-axis direction. So this anisotropy that is reported is found by two independent experiments, and it's very robust that this thing here appears only along the B-axis direction. Let me speak about competition. Here I'm plotting, this is early work from the Vancouver group. They were plotting the dome, and they basically interpreted this so-called YBCO plateau as a 1-8 anomaly. So that suggested already in 2006 that there was some kind of competing order to superconductivity. And when we had this low field L equal a half data, you can see that if you plot the charge density wave reflection, the amplitude of the reflection as function of temperature, and we find that it grows as you lower the temperature. It grows all the way until you hit TC, which is around here, and then if so you look at the black data, then it's suppressed. And the suppression is quite significant. It's a 50% effect. My view of this is that in zero magnetic field, the effect of this competition is much stronger on the charge density wave than it is on superconductivity. So in this competition here at zero field, it seems like superconductivity has the upper hand. We repeated the experiment along the B-axis direction, and we found very much the same as we had along the A-axis direction. Now, in recent years, people have been mapping out these domes here in high magnetic fields, and you can see that this what resembles just a plateau in zero magnetic field becomes extremely pronounced already at 15 Tesla, and at 30 Tesla, the single dome here splits into two domes. So let's look at some data of X-ray data at around 15 Tesla. I showed you already that along the A-axis direction, if we look at L equal 1, there's no action, so we haven't paid much attention to that. But we have measured very carefully the temperature dependence along the B-axis direction. And again, it's the same phenomenology. If you take the peak amplitude, or in this case the integrated intensity, and plot it as function of temperature, then it grows with temperature, but then at some point you have, if we take 15 Tesla, that's the blue here, you have a small suppression. And we interpret that as evidence of competition with superconductivity. But now at 15 Tesla, now it's a small effect, so basically the roles has flipped. The effect is much stronger on superconductivity than it is on a charge density wave. So now it's the charge density wave that has the upper hand. Okay, on my way to conclude, I just want to mention that David Leboeuf and his collaborators has measured very carefully the full high temperature, high field phase diagram of this charge density wave order. So there's starting to become some agreement on this phase. The last slide, I would mention some of the questions that I think would be nice to still understand. I think that these pulse field experiments, X-ray experiments, that's really the future. I think we can do a lot of more experiments on other systems in high magnetic fields. But this plot here shows that there's still some disagreements between the static field experiments and the pulse field experiments. I'm plotting here the correlation lengths, as I showed you before, and compare them to the pulse field experiments. And for some reasons that I would like to understand, there's some disagreement between the two techniques. It would also be nice to understand, so in the end we are interested in understanding these electronic transformations due to charge density wave order. I think we should do more experiments on the mercury compound. We have quantum oscillations in that compound, but there's not this phenomenology here that we have seen in YVCO, I think is not yet found in the mercury compound. Let me move to the second part of my talk. This would be on the lanthanum-based compounds. Here we went back to I think it's an old problem that several people have been thinking about. So it's the question of why TC is so different in the single layer compounds. So you can see that it varies by more than a factor of two if you go from the lanthanum-based compounds to the thallium and the mercury compounds. And empirically, it has been shown that it correlates with the apical oxygen distance. But the question is really, what is the underlying causality that explains this phenomenology? And there's a number of suggestions. One is from the group of Gabriel Cotier. They suggested that the apical oxygen controls the charge transfer gap, and that in turn is what determines the maximum the maximum TC you can have in a system. There was another proposal, and I think that came out of from inspiration again from the PNIPTides. So this is work from the Kuroki Sensei group and his collaborators. They suggested that basically the apical oxygen is controlling the splitting of the ED states, and this splitting would give you a different level of hybridization at the Fermi level between these orbitals, and the stronger hybridization, the lower would be the pairing strength. And so then we looked a bit into the literature, and we found that experimentally there's very little knowledge about the splitting of these ED states. One can get some insights from Rick's experiments that probes the DD excitations, but as you can see, it's kind of hard to disentangle these excitations. And if you look at these Rick's experiments, they would suggest that the DFT that underlied the arguments of the Japanese group, they suggest that the DFT is underestimating the splitting. So we decided just to try and measure exactly the Z band here by angle of sulfur emission. I would like to thank my collaborators. This is mainly driven by Christian Mark, who's a postdoc in my group, and the experiments was done at carried out at the Swiss light source. Here I'm showing you a so-called nodal cut. So this is a cut going from the zone corner through the zone center and to the zone corner again. And this is the photoemission spectra, binding energy, and this nodal cut direction here. And you see these fast dispersing bands. This is the well-known nodal dispersion that we have studied for decades now. But if you go down further down in binding energy around one electron volt, you can see that there's a hole-like band coming up. And it kind of tops right at the endpoint where the DFT suggested this the DZ square band. Okay, so then you might ask, how come that we suddenly can dig out that band? One of the parameters that we have been changing in the experiment is that's the photon energy. So we have been at synchrotrons where we can tune the energy, and most of the ARPAS data that exists in the literature is taken at fairly low energy. And for LASCO, most of the data is taken around 50 electron volts. If you measure around there, you will see the band, but you will not be able to see how it bends over, as shown here in these data. So there are some matrix elements into this problem. Now, we can even go to higher energies, and with this slide, I just want to show you that we can with a simple background subtraction, we can enhance the features that you see in the raw data. So you see this band here, and you see even a second band below. That's the band I showed you before. There's even bands below that. And we can enhance the contrast by subtracting a background. And I'm happy to explain you the details of that method. Then we went on. You can basically, when you have multibands, you can go into the PNIPTide literature and figure out how one would sort out the orbital character of these different bands. So this was the spectra I showed you before. It was taken with C+, which means that you would get all orbital characters. We can basically, by changing the light polarization, we can get out the orbital characters. Either we would get the dose that has even character with respect to the nodal cut, or we can get those who are those orbitals that are not even with respect to the nodal cut. So if we take pi polarizations, we'll get the even ones. So you can see that if we use pi polarization, we suppress completely the nodal dispersion. So there's no crossing at the Fermi level. So that's consistent. We would expect that this band here is the x squared minus y squared. So we can turn it off completely with light polarization, and we would get only those that are even. And if we would believe the DFT, then this one here would be the DZ band, and the band below would be the DXY. If we turn on again the nodal band, then we can actually measure it all the way down to the bottom. And so the bottom of this band is just below 2 eV. And we can get, there's another band here, which would be probably the XZ, YZ bands. Then we went on to do the KZ dependence. So one can measure the, we can measure at different KZ values. So first we did the DFT for different high symmetry directions in KZ. And the main difference, it's very similar, but the main difference is that at the A point, this DZ squared band is a bit more flat than at the end point. And so let me show you the data. So again, what we're doing is that we are making, different cuts, in-plane cuts, for a particular high symmetry point in KZ. So at this point, now we are at KZ zero, so that would be the gamma point. And so this is the band structure we get. Then we can move up to KZ equal to pi. And you can see, I hope you can see that this thing here, this is the, would correspond to the DZ square band. It's a bit more flat here when you are at the A point than when you are at the M point. And this could be a coincidence, but we can repeat it at higher zones. So we have repeated the experiments with some different cuts, different trajectory in plane. And so again, at the A point, it's a bit more flat than at the M point. The white lines here are a tight binding model. So we made a tight binding model with two orbitals. We took the dz squared and the x squared minus y squared orbitals and made a tight binding model and fitted it to the data. We included hopping parameters, in-plane hopping parameters for each of the orbitals, and for the dz squared orbital, we had two out-of-plane hoppings. And in addition to that, we needed to include a coupling between the bands. And it turns out that it has to be a repulsive coupling. So along the nodes and the nodal directions, the coupling is zero. But at the antinode, which is R or X here, the coupling is maximum. And it's a repulsive coupling, and that's explained why this band is dipping here, and it's pushing up the Van Hove singularity. So that explains why the Van Hove singularity in the lanthanum-based compounds are so close to the Fermi level. This is another way. So this is our tight binding parameters, and this is basically the full 3D band structure along the nodal direction. So you can see that this DZ squared band here is actually having a dispersion along the KC direction. A few comments on the tight binding. We had earlier this week we were discussing what is the out-of-plane hopping, and that was important for the discussion of the specific heat enhancement around the doping where the pseudo gap is vanishing. So there was discussion whether this could also be caused by the Van Hove crossing with the Fermi level. This is the hopping we find, and it's purely so we only included out of plane hoppings for this orbital. If we take the tight binding model seriously, then it implies that we would have a significant hybridization of the two orbitals at the Fermi level. And theoretically, the expectation would be that that it should restrain superconductivity. The next generation of experiments we're going to do is to try and experimentally determine how much is the hybridization actually suppressing superconductivity. And with this, I would like to thank you for the attention.
I guess Mike is alive. With respect to the hybridization, I take it the direction you're going is as you reduce the hybridization at the Fermi surface with the DEZ squared orbit, you expect TC to go up?
If I reduce the hybridization, it should go up, yeah.
Okay.
Yes.
Which is Kuroki and
company. Yes.
Yeah, I think we call it distillation.
Yeah.
Orbital distillation.
Yeah.
From your talk, it's not clear to me you have evidence that this is what does it. Are you moving, did your talk say you're moving in the direction to answer that question? Can you answer it now?
Yes. So I think the first step in the colloquial picture is actually to figure out where is the DZ band, and I think we have shown that. And I think it's the position of that makes it very likely that we have hybridization at the Fermi level. Then I think the next step experimentally is to actually demonstrate that this hybridization has a significant effect. And so that I haven't proven, so that was what I'm saying. This would be the next generation of experiments to be done.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Me? Yeah, yeah. This goes back to my own history a long time ago. Somewhere in 1989, Antonio Bianconi et al. Were claiming, based on polarized X-ray absorption involving both copper L2, L3, and oxygen pre-peaks, that there was quite a large DZ squared admixture, right? In this way, you just count the total number of, say, long time ago, Z squared electrons occupied or holes occupied in the ground state, with quite a high density of these Z squared holes. I went to Bell Labs, and the first talk I gave at Bell Labs was about this. I had a wild theory that this was good for subconductivity. And then Michael Schluter decided to activate CT Shen to check it with his Dragon Beamline, and then CT et al. Produced a paper that landed in Fischer's Letters, I think in 1991, or so perhaps 1992, showing that there was zero Z squared density. Now, when you ask my strong opinion, this X-ray absorption method is way better in figuring that out than whatever you can do with photoemission. You need models, blah, 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 blah.
Yes.
Are you aware of that?
I'm not aware of Bianconi's work. I'm aware of the PRL. I've read that.
Yeah.
And I think one of the, I think that one reason is that in that paper, I think they assume that you can only get the DZ unoccupied states at the apical oxygen. They're assuming that you can only probe it basically at the apical oxygen. But the fact you can see...
They look at oxygen pre-peak, right? That was the same.
I'm wondering, why did they come to that conclusion? And I think the underlying assumption in the analysis is that you get the DZ squared band,
yeah,
or unoccupied states at the apical oxygen, and you get the x squared minus y squared at the in-plane oxygen. I think that's the underlying
assumption. I remember that vaguely, yeah, yeah.
And now I see that this DZ square band is having a huge, and the dispersion in plane is much larger than out of plane. So I'm wondering whether their assumption or their results are really, I think the results is correct, but the interpretation we might be able to revise it with these results here, that one should be more careful, I think, it's less simple to disentangle the two contributions. So that could actually reconcile Bianconi's and the Bell Labs.
Bianconi was doing the same thing and was just not lined up correctly or something of the kind.
Pardon?
Bianconi was doing exactly the same thing as CT Shen. I mean, CT Shen just checked it, right?
And I see.
That didn't line up the samples properly or something of the kind. Okay, good. Yeah, I listen.
So presumably one of the things you want to do is to compare the position of the DZ squared orbital in another cuprate. Is there another cuprate that you can do a similar experiment?
Yes, I think that's one, yeah. I mean, the BISCO, singular BISCO would be the next one.
Uh-huh.
We have done the europium-doped LSO. So I did what I presented was LASCO, overdoped LASCO. It's in a tetragonal phase because that makes it easy to compare. We have done it on the undertop LSO, the band is there. We have done it in the LCT phase in European doped LSO, and the band is there. So I think one can do it as function of doping in LASCO. One should do it in the bismuth compounds, and then one could progressively. Probably we should just go and we should go back to this graph here. One should just move up.
Yeah.
And of course the experiment is going to be harder as you move up. But I think now, in some sense, we have the recipe for how to do it. We know more or less we have to go up in photon energy, and it's a matter of tuning the photon energy to get the best matrix elements.
I see, but I guess the thallium has good surfaces, so you can do the...
Yeah, thallium can be done, this one can be done, and so one can move up this way.
So, more questions?
Now that you know the Charles Sensitive Wave cues and geometry very well, have you or anybody drawn what the Fermi surfaces look like and compared any of that to the magneto oscillations? Is there any correspondence? Has light been shed on the original motivation?
Yes. I think that's still, I mean, we still need to make this bridge between the Charles Sensitive Wave order and what is exactly the electronic structure in high field of YBCO. And I think it's unclear whether, I think there's still debate of whether, is it the 2D Charles Sensitive Wave order that folds or reconstructs? Is that the dominating one? Or is it the high field unidirectional density wave that is making the quantum oscillations? I think this is not so clear, and
you have lots of pockets of electrons and holes given the cues that you see, is that correct?
I don't know actually in what exactly it would give. Are you referring to the 2D or the 1D?
2D.
So the low field charged. Or the high field or the low field?
High field.
So that would be unidirectional along the b-axis direction.
What do the Fermi surfaces look like in that case?
I don't know, actually, to be honest. Maybe there's other people who have considered that.
I mean, you can get various forms of Fermi surface. You can even get the right sorts of pockets. But you also have lots of other Fermi surfaces. And I think for any of these charge density waves, if you just take band structure and don't put in some ansatz for the pseudo gap, but just take band structure plus charge density wave, you get a whole slew of well, I don't know. You can get pockets with the right period.
You get lots of others.
But you get lots of specific heat.
No, but you also get lots of other pockets which should be seen in magneto oscillation.
Not necessarily. For the unidirectional one, you get lots of one-dimensional bands, so those wouldn't give quantum oscillation. So if your only goal is to agree with the quantum oscillations, you can do it with unidirectional order. If you also insist on agreeing with the specific heat measurements, you're in serious trouble.
Can I ask another question? At your largest field, is there any estimate of the amplitude of the charge density wave that you can make?
So you're referring to what kind of distortion it would make? Yes, I'm not sure. I mean, it's something we can dig out. So of course these intensities here would translate into you should compare them to the Bragg peaks, nearby Bragg peaks, and this ratio would give you or tell you how large your distortions is. And it's you know, these ones are the 2D or these reflections here was they are a million times weaker than. They are a million times weaker than the Bragg peak. So it's a very, very tiny effect. Yeah, so you can look in our papers. We have quoted them. They're very weak, million times weaker than the Bragg peaks.
So I have one question.
Yes.
So you mentioned in response to a question that you showed that you've done photo emission on the 12% LCO and europium doped LCO. So have you done the KZ dependence on those as well?
No.
Okay. I'm just thinking that might. So from some of this early, some of these early measurements, I thought part of the conclusion was that DZ squared didn't play a big role through optimal doping, but that there might be a bit more coming in as you overdope.
Yes.
And so it could be interesting to see, because you've got the most complete data on the overdope side, and so it might be interesting to do a similarly thorough job on the underdope.
I agree with you that one could do basically take now the recipe that we have found for the overdope, to just go through the phase diagram and find the doping dependence. That's, yeah, we only have three compounds for the moment, but I think that's another direction that one can follow.
Just now that you that plot up, so on the phase diagram on the right hand side. So, do I interpolate correctly that basically the 17 tesla where the 3D order sets in, that's exactly where, at this doping, you have suppressed superconductivity to zero temperature.
Yeah, I mean, so this is.
So if I extrapolate that to 17 tesla, I would guess that that's roughly where.
Close.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's really, but the 3D order sets in at a finite temperature.
The 3D order sets in, yeah, at finite temperature.
But it happens at the field where you've suppressed the superconductivity to zero temperature.
So that's a bit funny. I mean, part of it, yeah. Superconductivity is strongly suppressed at 15 tesla. Superconductivity is still here at 15, and the onset is between 14 and 15.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's just a bit curious.
Yes.
For the low field CDW, at least some people, Forgan et al., have attempted a refinement of what the lattice distortions look like. Is that possible for the high field?
Yes or no? So we have in Nature Communication paper, we have in the supplementary material here. We have, I think we have measured 14 of these peaks, and we have a table, and there's, I think, 13 feed parameters in Ted Forgan's model. So that's the difficulty is that to make a refinement, you need a lot of peaks, and so we have 14, and they are at L equal 1 and 2. We need higher L's, and that means you have to rotate the sample, and then you rotate it out of the field direction, and so you lose the phase. So it's a bit constrained to Ted, he applied immediately his model to the data we have already. It just the peaks we have is more or less consistent with what he would. Along the lines what you have already published. So it looks like the model can also be extended.
Okay, I don't see any more questions, so let's thank Johan once more.